65-year-old Richard J.L. Barrow will walk 1,200 miles from Steinbrenner Field in Tampa to Yankee Stadium in New York as a tribute to his late nephew, Gary, who died in the September 11th attacks in New York in 2001. Welcome to the RotoWire Fantasy Baseball Podcast, powered by DraftKings.com, America's favorite one-day fantasy baseball site. Derek Van Riper here with James Anderson. It is Monday, March 2nd, and the year is 2015. Now, really cool open today. In addition to walking in honor of Gary, Richard L. Barrow is also raising money for the Wounded Warrior Project. You can donate at Richard's, it's called richardsyankeeswalk.org. That's Richards, plural, yankeeswalk.org. If you listen to us on iTunes or Stitcher, you can please rate and review our podcast. We'd greatly appreciate that. We are in full spring training schedule mode at this point. Episodes will be typically released in the evening, Monday through Friday, until the regular season begins. At that point, we're going to shift to our Sunday night through Thursday night recording schedule as we had last year. James, what's going on? How's it going today?
Oh, not too bad. Usually we do the prospect pod on Monday as well, but that's actually going to be recorded tomorrow, which will be Tuesday, if you're listening to this sometime in the early afternoon with Clay Link. So look for that one tomorrow evening.
Yeah, you'll have an article sort of corresponding with that, the Farm Futures piece. NL Central is the focus this week. I imagine that'll be a big focus of the podcast too, but that article should be up on the site probably by the time anyone's listening to this podcast. If you're not currently a subscriber, RotoWire.com/pod. You can go ahead and check out the site for free for the next 10 days. No credit card required. Let's take a look at some of the big headlines here from the last 48 hours or so. Chris Sale is unlikely to be ready to start on opening day for the White Sox. He suffered an avulsion fracture in his foot while stepping off of his truck this weekend. Maybe this opens up an opportunity for Carlos Rodon as a starter to begin the year. Jeff Samardzija would probably take the ball on opening day if Sale is not ready. This sounds like a bizarre story. I mean, anytime you have a player, I think we were talking about this earlier in the office, you have a player that has a strange injury that happens at home, you kind of raise an eyebrow because the details are always a little bit sketchy. I feel like more details often a bad thing. Like this Sale one isn't as unusual as Clint Barmas tripping down the stairs while carrying deer meat, specifically deer meat, not just meat or groceries or a bag. So maybe this is just a legitimate slip and fall sort of situation. I mean, K-Rod stepped on a cactus in spring training, I want to say last year, maybe it was 2 years ago now. Jonathan Lucroy had a suitcase fall on his hand.
Lots of stuff with luggage and stairs and pools, the kind of stuff that really kind of brings you back to when you're in like high school or, you know, you're young and you're living with your parents and you kind of feel the need to make up excuses to kind of hide the embarrassment of certain mistakes that you made as a young person, and that's kind of what a lot of this kind of comes across as. Don Cooper, the White Sox pitching coach, said that he thinks it's more likely that Carlos Rodon would make the rotation out of camp if Chris Sale isn't ready for the start of the season. That kind of seems obvious, but just the fact that he suggested that Rodon has a chance to make it to start the season kind of tells me that they're going to be using him as a starter this year when he's up with the White Sox.
Yeah, I mean, what they could do is have him open in the rotation, make him the fifth starter. They may not even need him in the rotation. They could have him as a long reliever available to start and sort of base it off of Sale's recovery once April gets here. I mean, I could see him being optioned down at some point, pitching a little bit of AAA, coming back up when a starter gets hurt. I mean, the White Sox are going to rely on John Danks, whose contract basically keeps him in the rotation. Hector Nwesi as options in the back. I mean, you take those two guys, neither are locked to perform at a high level. And with the White Sox, with the offseason they had, clearly this is a team that now has playoff aspirations.
Yeah, there should definitely be situations that arise where Rodon is the preferable option in the rotation, whether it be for a short stretch or a long stretch. So I definitely think he's going to have value at some point in mixed leagues this year.
Thinking in terms of Sale's ranking right now, and the early indications are that he's going to probably miss approximately 3 weeks of spring training. It's going to be a little bit tricky for him to get fully stretched out the first time his turn would come up, even as the fifth starter. So it wouldn't surprise me if he missed two turns in the White Sox rotation, maybe a mid-April return. I'm kind of taking away a start or two right now. I'm not really sure if I'm going to take away more than that, I'd have to get more information. He'd have to be delayed more than the White Sox expect him to be for me to significantly change him. But he did have some separation in my previous set of rankings over some of the other second-tier pitchers. Now I think he just kind of falls into that pack where, whereas before I would have preferred Sale to, say, David Price, I think Sale maybe goes to the bottom of that bunch of guys that were all kind of lumped together.
Yeah, on the radio show on Saturday, I said that I would kind of lump him. I probably would still have him ahead of Price just right now, but I had him ahead of Scherzer and Strasburg when we did the rankings. Now I think I would have him just slightly behind those two guys, but I would still have him as my number fifth starter with Felix and Kershaw also being ahead of him. I don't know. I mean, the thing that kind of worries me is it is his landing foot, so that, I mean, if you were to pick which foot it was going to be, I would assume you'd prefer it to not be the landing foot just because of how much, you know, he's going to put weight down on that continuously. I'm not super worried, though, just because I think it seems like they're just taking the very, very cautious route here where they just really want to make sure they don't rush him back, and it doesn't seem like he's going to miss all of April.
Yeah, I get that feeling, too, but just to kind of quantify again where I'd put him, I mean, Kershaw was ahead of him previously. Obviously, that's going to hold up. I would move Sale behind King Felix, behind Strasburg, behind Price, and behind Max Scherzer. I think I would still keep Sale ahead of Johnny Cueto. I think that's where my break was between Scherzer and Cueto. Now Sale just occupies that spot, probably a late second round, early third round pick if you're talking about an NFBC 15-team mixer.
Yeah, and you know, ideally, maybe he falls because of this injury, so maybe you can kind of swoop in and grab him at even more of a discount than that if there's a kind of a hesitant draft room.
Yeah, let's take a look here at a former White Sox, Addison Reed, who's been dealing with a shoulder injury here this spring. He may be in danger of missing opening day. Now, he told reporters on Sunday the soreness in his shoulder had subsided. Diamondbacks manager Chip Hale actually expressed some concern. It seems like he's still a couple of weeks away from throwing from a mound, and even as a reliever, that could force him to miss the opener. I mean, I think the question just becomes, who would you expect to close in that bullpen if Reed's not healthy? Because one issue is that Brad Ziegler is coming off of knee surgery. I feel like he'd typically be that next guy up, but he's having a relatively abnormal spring training. I mean, just missing some workouts and not necessarily being 100% or available on back-to-back days to begin the season. I think it's a little bit uncertain as to what they're going to get from him in April. Are there any other relievers in this depth chart, on this depth chart, that stand out to you as particularly skilled guys that you want to have?
Not really. I don't think that just the fact that I think Addison Reed will be closing for them sooner than later after the start of the regular season, it's tough. I mean, you'd have to be in a pretty deep league to roster a guy like Evan Marshall and kind of hope that gets you four or five saves or something like that. They also have some like starting pitchers that are kind of failed guys or kind of often injured guys that maybe their stuff would play up much better in the bullpen than some of these relievers they have there, but I don't know if they'd be willing to just throw those guys into the ninth inning just yet. I think you're right. I think Ziegler would be the guy if he were to be kind of fully healthy, but I just think this is a situation I'm going to stay away from.
I'd get pretty excited if they decided to make Ruby De La Rosa a reliever, because I think he'd have the best skills of anybody at their disposal, and I think he's good enough to where if they ever made a change like that, I could see him keeping the job over Reed. Mm-hmm. Whereas Marshall or Oliver Perez maybe could work in tandem. Maybe a guy like Matt Stites or Randall Delgado could handle it temporarily. You're right, though. It's a long list of names, both for the bullpen and the rotation right now, where you really just don't know how things are going to line up when this season begins. But I think you're right. Evan Marshall's more of a flyer in deeper leagues, and you're only expecting a handful of saves potentially if Reed misses any time at all. Miguel Cabrera took batting practice on the field Monday, just the latest in a small series of steps he's making as he returns from the surgery to repair the navicular bone in his foot. The next roundtable is going to come up in the next few weeks, and I don't know if there's anything Miggy can do for me to upgrade him health-wise, like in terms of my rankings. I think I've gotten to the point where I'm just worried that this is sort of like his plantar fasciitis in terms of like Albert Pujols a few years ago, where even if he's still a very good hitter, or even a great hitter, that maybe we're going to start to see that slow decline from him, and that having him in the 8 to 12 range makes more sense than saying he's a lock as a top 5 pick still.
Yeah, I kind of had a lot of this factored in on that first set of rankings. I think I had him eighth, maybe eighth or ninth. And, I had Carlos Gomez over him, which I don't know if a lot of people did originally. I definitely had Kershaw over him, Abreu, Goldschmidt, those guys. I might even move Edwin Encarnacion, maybe even, I don't know. After that, it kind of gets a little dicey for me. But, guys like Anthony Rendon, Robinson Cano, Jose Bautista, I'd consider all those guys in that same sort of class. I don't want to end up with Cabrera in any leagues, but I don't know if I could move him much lower than I already had him in the first set.
I think I could maybe put him back ahead of Anthony Rizzo if he's healthy at the end of spring training. But I'm pretty sure I'd rather have Abreu. I'd rather have an Edwin Encarnacion. I've got Bautista ahead of him. I think Bautista's power is just as safe as Cabrera's at this point of their respective careers. And the park's a big factor, too.
I just don't know how you could project Miggy to get above the 30-homer plateau with any kind of confidence this year. I think that the batting average, I'll still buy into as long as he's out there and playing. But if you're taking a first baseman with your first pick in the draft and he hits you 24 or 26 homers, that could be trouble. So, the power is my big concern, and I definitely would take both those Blue Jays guys to outperform in that category.
Yeah, I think that's the key with Miggy is that the batting average may be a bigger source of his value than ever, and that's often a category that we overlook. So it becomes even trickier to evaluate him, even if he's healthy, given the trends with the power. But I would take him over Adam Jones for what it's worth at this point. Jones, to me, everyone keeps saying he's the safe first-round pick, but you're only safe and reliable until you're not. And I think this could be that year where Jones is still good. What if he's a third or fourth round type player next year? Would that really surprise you? Like if this time next year we're talking about Adam Jones being available 45th or 50th overall in drafts, and that's assuming a healthy season, I wouldn't be surprised by that at all.
No, I don't think so. I wouldn't be surprised. Any number of guys that are going after him could outperform him this year, and you wouldn't be surprised at all.
Let's move on to some other first-round picks, at least former first-round picks in one case. Carlos Gonzalez and Troy Tulowitzki ran the bases Monday. Both could return to spring games sooner than expected. There really hasn't been a discount on Tulowitzki based on what we've seen in previous years. Still seeing him go around 15th overall, whereas Cargo is going probably about 30 picks later than that in many leagues. But for Cargo, to me, the lack of production on a per-game basis was the result of having multiple injuries last year. It was the knee and it was the finger. He had the fatty mass removed, the benign tumor, I think they even referred to it as. A very odd sort of thing. Did they say a tentacled mass?
That was him. Yeah, that was probably one of the weirder injury descriptions of 2014.
And all I could picture was a Pac-Man ghost, because that's a tentacled mass. It's it's the little ghost with the little tentacles running around the maze in Pac-Man. That's what I could see. But maybe Cargo actually is at the point where I want to start thinking about buying him, because it seems like his spring training is progressing about as normal as it could for the injuries that he's coming back from. Running the bases now, more than a month away from opening day, this was a player that this time last year people were willing to take as a late first round pick in some formats. And really, how much has changed for him? Unless you think that knee is going to be an ongoing source of problems, maybe this is a good time to jump in and buy.
Yeah, I had him ranked kind of in that George Springer, Matt Kemp, Justin Upton sort of range among that second or third tier of outfielders, and I feel pretty comfortable with that. If I ended up with him instead of any of those guys, I wouldn't be too upset about it. Obviously, I like him a lot more in shallower leagues, because when he eventually does go on the DL for whatever the injury is this upcoming year, you can replace him with a pretty good bat off the waiver wire, whereas in deeper leagues, that can be tougher to do. It's also, he's 29, I believe, which could be kind of the beginning of kind of a second stage in his career. He might still be in his prime, but it also wouldn't be surprising at all if some of the decline in production is somewhat related to maybe his best days being behind him.
I do like that he's going to play a corner. They're not going to try to put him in center field anymore. Charlie Blackman's expected to be the regular center fielder for the Rockies, and they'll platoon Blackman with Drew Stubbs, and Brandon Barnes might be in the mix too as far as defensive options at that spot. But having Dickerson and Gonzalez in the corners, I think, makes a lot of sense at this point. But with Cargo, did you rank him behind Dickerson, ahead of Dickerson? Because I've seen, I had Dickerson about 20 spots ahead, and that was sight unseen on Cargo this spring, knowing that if he came through spring training healthy, he'd be one of the bigger movers up the board. How did you stack him up compared to the other outfielders?
Yeah, I had Dickerson 11 spots ahead of him, which is, you know, pretty reasonable. I think Dickerson's just so much safer, and that seems weird because he's only got the 1 year of this kind of track record, but just with the games played, I think he's safer. And I mean, I don't know, I think the production could be similar, especially in the power categories.
Let's take a look here at another injured player. Jason Kipnis will miss the Indians' first 3 to 4 spring training games. He suffered the injury to his finger in December while lifting weights, and I was burned by Kipnis in the NFBC last year. He was a mid-second round pick for me there. The oblique injury early in the season really slowed him down. The power dried up. The batting average took a hit. Stolen bases were still there, and he's been a pretty good base stealer throughout his time in the big league, so I feel like he's pretty safe in that category. Should score a decent number of runs, should drive in a decent number of runs, but this finger injury gave me some pause. When I heard about this in December, my goal in targeting him, I think, sort of evaporated. I think I look at him now as almost too risky to have anywhere unless he falls even further than his current ADP.
Yeah, second base is tough for me just because I love Colton Wong so much, and I really love where he's going in draft. So I'm going to end up with him pretty much everywhere, I'm guessing. And so if Kipnis goes ahead of him, or, you know, for some reason I miss on Wong, maybe I'll consider Kipnis if he's sitting there. But I really think he gets outperformed by Wong this year, and maybe even Brian Dozier, who I think he's very similar to. So I might just kind of sit around, and if someone wants to buy into Kipnis, I mean, Kipnis burned me in stake league, him and along with, you know, 6 or 7 other guys burned me in that league. But yeah, I mean, if he's really falling and I miss out on some of my targets, I might take him, but I'm not going to reach on him with the bounce back in mind.
Now, I had him behind D. Gordon, who I don't think I'll get anywhere. I had him more than 30 spots behind Brian Dozier and Ian Kinsler, and I think Kinsler has his share of flaws too, but I see a lot of risk with Jason Kipnis right now. The Indians actually have a lot of middle infielders too, so if you get to the point where Kipnis is struggling to hit at all, I mean, which defense has really been more of his issue as a big league player, they've got alternatives. I mean, they bring up Francisco Lindor. Jose Ramirez, yeah, could push him for playing time at second base.
I also really like Neil Walker at that position this year. So, I mean, if I miss on a guy like Wong, I might just wait back on Walker because I think he's getting underdrafted for the power that he can offer at that position. But, yeah, I'm with you. I mean, the Indians definitely have options there, and, you know, Mike Avilas too. So, I mean, there's plenty of guys they have.
Definitely agree with you, though, as far as Neil Walker being undervalued. Got him for $5 in Staff 1 last year in the auction. Really bad inflation, like a lot worse than the Staff 2 league that we're in.
I was
shocked that he was available. I would have thought make $15-$18 for a player like that, $5, and I'll have him for at least a couple of years at that price. Might even get to the point where I extend him in a year, but nevertheless, Neil Walker does seem undervalued in redraft leagues here this spring. Sticking with injured player follow-ups, Alex Gordon has no timetable to face live pitching as he recovers from a wrist injury. He's been limited to soft toss thus far. This seems problematic even if he's cleared to play on opening day. I could see his power numbers, especially in the first half, taking a really big hit as a result of this injury, especially given how much he's been limited early on here in spring training.
Yeah, I definitely think the concern here isn't when he comes back. It's more what he does when he comes back. And, you know, he kind of fits the profile of a guy who's just going to get too hyped up based on the name value and the fact that his defense was awesome last year. So there was some MVP buzz and everything like that. You know, if people are kind of scrambling for like a second outfielder, they might see his name and be like, oh, you know, I can trust Alex Gordon. He was really good last year. But I definitely think there's guys going way later than him that I like a little bit more.
I don't expect to end up with Gordon in any leagues unless the discount is enormous. I mean, I don't have this bias against players named Gordon. It's just random that I don't like D. Gordon or Alex Gordon this year. I think my ranking has him at least 30 spots below his current ADP. The ADP might fall, but I could see his ranking falling for me too, where I bump him down below Avisail Garcia, for example. I'd much rather have Avisail Garcia.
I'll throw it out there. I mean, I was just about to go there, but I would take a couple guys in that division over him in Oswaldo Arcia and Avisail Garcia. I have them ranked ahead of him right now as is, and I know that I can get him later than him in most drafts.
Yeah, I mean, the auction format too. It's like Alex Gordon, just the player that I'm not going to pay for this year. What about a guy like AJ Pollock? They do slightly different things because Pollock runs more. I mean, would you rather have Pollock than Alex Gordon?
I have Gordon ranked ahead of Pollock, at least on the first round table we did, but you know, based on what the price is going to be on draft day, I'd much rather have Pollock. Steven Sousa is another guy I'd probably rather have. Gregory Polanco. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine him going at a price where I can justify buying him.
Yeah, I imagine Gordon falls 50 to 60 spots the next time I go through these rankings and make the necessary adjustments. So that's pretty much going to put me out on having any shares of Gordon here in 2015. Let's take a look here at Chase Utley. He's been dealing with an ankle injury that popped up over the course of the offseason. According to the Phillies, he's not going to play in spring games for a while, which is a nice unit of measurement when you're talking about your injured players. I mean, the team context is bad. The price actually for Chase Utley, I think, is generally pretty reasonable, but the nature of that injury makes me just wonder if he's going to need regular days off early in the year and if maybe the skills are going to start to dry up here as he continues to age and now has to battle an injury.
It's kind of nice because this is the injury that usually comes up in like mid-May where you have him and you enjoy 4 or 5 nice weeks of production early in the season, and then he kind of gets out for an indefinite period of time. So this way, I mean, you can definitely stay away from him and you have no one to blame but yourself if this is a lingering thing during the season. I just look at the kind of projections, you know, like Steamer, Pakoda, none of them have him being, you know, above average, even when he's like on the field. So, I mean, I think you're just going to get kind of Scooter Gennett level production maybe if he is healthy, and that might be the high end. So, yeah, I don't see a lot of upside here, especially in shallower leagues.
The best thing about Chase Utley the last couple of years has been the way he's utilized on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. I think Chase Utley is going to go down as one of the better middle infielders of the last 15, 20 years. Like he's that good. I mean,
his peak years were really, really good.
I wonder though if he is one of those players who will fall just short. Like he'll be considered a great for the Phillies, but not a guy that gets into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I don't think he makes it. I mean, even if you're just an all prime years guy. There's only, you know, a handful of them really. Well, he was 7 or better Fangraphs WAR from 2005 to 2009, which is solid. I mean, that's really good. I mean, that's MVP level basically. But then before and after that, it's kind of a fall off to more kind of a middle of the road kind of guy. So great peak, but yeah, I don't think there's enough overall to get him in.
Compared to average Hall of Famers at second base, his peak, his 7-year peak, actually was better in terms of WAR, but the overall career body of work, he lags about 8 wins above replacement behind the average Hall of Famer at second base. So it's going to be really, the voters could actually swing it. I mean, like this is the type of player that they can push through if for one reason or another. The criteria they use favors Utley. If they look at him and say, well, he's a 6-time All-Star, so I want him to get in, and you know,
he was really nice to the media.
Really friendly to the media. 4 silver sluggers, you know, whatever it might be that flips their switch, maybe he's got a shot. But I think he's just on the outside looking in, even though it's been a really nice career overall for Chase Utley. One more injury item I want to get to in depth. Alan Craig, according to Red Sox manager John Farrell, has much more life in his bat. Craig was coming off an ankle injury last year, and obviously he was with the Cardinals this time last year, really didn't ever seem to get back on track. And I didn't want shares of Craig a year ago. I think he was just inside the top 100 in terms of ADP. But I kind of like him now because he's probably going 150, 200 picks later. Concern, obviously, where does he play in Boston? Corners are very crowded, even first base at DH, very much crowded right now. A trade still seems likely, whether it's Craig going somewhere else or one of those other options getting traded, maybe even two of them. Do you look at Craig as someone that could come in and hit 290, maybe 300 again over a full season, albeit with 12 or 15 home runs instead of the 20-plus that some people project him for?
You know, the batting average and the RBI on a nice team is kind of the one takeaway that I'd be kind of intrigued by. I don't see him as a power hitter really anymore. I think, you know, doubles and just a lot of doubles and a lot of RBIs, I think you'd see. But I don't know if they can really move him just kind of based on what his value is. And and the money left on that deal, I think it'd be kind of tough to get him out of there. And then even if they moved somebody else, I don't know, you know, are they going to be able to move Victorino or Napoli? I don't really see that either. So I think that maybe just based on Victorino and Napoli's like past injury history, maybe it just makes sense to hold Craig and just use him as a backup and, you know, give him three or four starts a week at first or in right field.
I do wonder if a team like Baltimore would be interested, but I also have a hard time seeing the Red Sox finding a significant deal with the Orioles. I see teams like that swapping smaller pieces. Maybe Craig's considered a smaller piece at this point, but I do wonder how comfortable they are relying heavily on Alejandro Deaza, you know, the Steve Pierce, Delman Young, a couple of righties right now kind of penciled in as the DH. Like they're a little thin on the corners. It seems like it'd be a good fit for a team like that.
Yeah, it's going to be tough though, because if you had your scouts watching Craig towards the end of last year, or just even any time last year, they're not going to have anything nice to say about him, because he was kind of a mess all season long, especially with the Cardinals, and then he wasn't playing every day with the Red Sox. So it's going to be hard to find a good scouting report on him from the past year.
Also, the angle of, do the Cardinals trade away good players very often?
No.
Typically, that's part of their model, is they don't do that. So
that's why I'm not touching Shelby Miller.
Yeah, Shelby, even though it used to be the Braves were the team that you didn't want to buy pitchers from, I don't want to go ahead. I'm not doing it. Not expecting Shelby Miller to rediscover the magic, get those secondaries back in order, and bounce back with Atlanta. Got a series of loose ends here. I'll run through these. You can kind of let me know if any of these things are of interest to you. Michael Brantley is going to make his spring debut on Thursday. Previously, he was slowed by a sore lower back. Matt Harvey faced live hitters in a 26-pitch bullpen session on Monday. We also saw a bullpen session from Adam Wainwright. He's been dealing with that abdominal strain that caused him to fly back to St. Louis last week. We saw Masahiro Tanaka go up against live hitters for the first time this spring on Monday. Hyunjin Ryu threw a bullpen session Monday. He's likely to have at least another side session, possibly a simulated game also, before he makes his spring debut. An MRI last week showed no real structural issues with Ryu's back. In the least surprising news tidbit I've seen in a long time, Clayton Kershaw is going to start on opening day for the Dodgers, just in case you're wondering. Who would have thought they'd go that route?
I hope you don't mind I didn't write a note on that.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Andrelton Simmons has recovered from his oblique injury. He may be held out of games until next week. Doesn't seem like that's going to really linger on into the season. Also think I saw something about Lucas Duda closing in on taking some swings here in the next few days. That would certainly be a way for him maybe to kind of stabilize his value, I guess you'd say, as we move through the early weeks of spring training. We got one signing. Dion Viciado has signed with the Blue Jays. Over the weekend, we also found, I think it was late Friday, Michael Saunders' injury is not as bad as previously feared, only because he had a significant portion of his meniscus removed, which actually speeds up the timetable. If you try to repair the meniscus, it takes like a half season to return. If you just take the meniscus out or take out a chunk of it, you can return in more like 4 to 6 weeks. So we could see Saunders back in early April. But Dion Viciado for the Blue Jays, worth the flyer?
Not for me. I mean, I think that he might actually be competing with Danny Valencia for a job on that team, just kind of as a guy to face lefties in the DH spot, just because I don't, this news about Saunders, it doesn't make much sense to really use Viciado in the outfield on a regular basis, because you're probably not going to need him there. So yeah, I'm not going to go after Viciado, maybe in a daily format if it's a nice pitching matchup and he makes the team, but he might not even make the team.
Yeah, he gets into the stack for me if I'm loading up on with Blue Jays against a weak pitcher, but that's probably the only way that Dion Viciado finds his way onto any of my rosters over the course of this season. Opening day is almost here, and while we prep for season-long leagues this month, DraftKings.com has hundreds of contests running every day throughout March for the NBA, NHL, college hoops, PGA, and soccer. Sign up today at DraftKings.com. Clay and I talked toss-ups on Friday. We were looking at a bunch of different hitters, and these are just simple ADP-type decisions, guys that are going to be available around the same time of your snake drafts. And for our purposes, we're assuming a 15-team mixer, 14 hitters, 9 pitchers, so a pretty basic format. We'll start with some starting pitchers here, James. David Price versus Corey Kluber. If you're looking at that in the early rounds, which direction are you leaning?
I'd go Price. I love Kluber. I buy into him big time, but Price is good enough to where I think that the any kind of uncertainty you might have at all about whether or not Kluber was for real last year, I mean, the safety that Price offers is enough for me to take him.
Yeah, I mean, look at the workload that Price took last year, 248 and a third innings. If he does that again, I think another 275, 280K type season is possible. I almost wonder, too, if we're going to get one more year where the ratios go completely elite, where we get that ERA in the mid to low twos. Like, I feel like that's a possibility for Price, even though the defense behind him in Detroit probably isn't as good as some of the defenses he's had behind him throughout his career in Tampa Bay.
Yeah, that is kind of a concern, because last year especially he was pitching to, he was either striking guys out or the ball was getting hit weakly in play, because he was teetering on Cliff Lee levels of walking guys last year. So I mean, that could be an issue if he just has some really bad BABIP games, could take some bad losses. But yeah, I really trust the strikeouts, and I trust him to get to 200 plus innings. So yeah, I'll go Price.
I also have Price ahead of Kluber at this point. 3.11 ERA, 1.05 WHIP for Mr. David Price last year before the trade. 3.59 ERA, 1.15 WHIP after being traded to the Tigers. Even though he had 82 strikeouts in 77 and two thirds, only walked 15 guys in his last 11 starts. I mean, that's ridiculous. The one thing that did improve significantly were the home runs. He allowed 20 home runs in those first 23 starts with Tampa, just 5 in those last 11 with the Tigers. But Tampa's a good place to pitch, too, so the park effect really shouldn't matter that much. I mean, it's slightly worse, I think, technically, moving to Detroit, but not enough to where you really would make an adjustment. Let's take a look here at a second-tier couple of pitchers. We have Jeff Samardzija, Julio Teheran. I mean, for me, Teheran is going to fall behind Samardzija in strikeouts. I don't think you're going to see that next level from him in that category. Whereas I look at the skills growth Samardzija showed last year, and I'm buying into all of it. The grounders, the improved control, the strikeouts, I think all of that can hold up. The park effects are going to bump the ERA up a little bit. But ultimately, I like the run support a lot. I think the bullpen is passable. I mean, it's not great, but it's good enough where you're not completely worried every time he leaves the game after 6 or after 7. So I've got Samardzija over Teheran. Is that something you agree with?
You know, these have been really good ones, because both guys are really close in my rankings. Definitely can see the case for either guy. I'm going to be taking, if I take one of these guys, and I doubt I will because I think I'm a little lower on both of them than the general public, but if I take one of them, it's going to be my number two starter, maybe even my number three starter if I get a couple of aces early. And at that point, I'm just looking for like the safest kind of package that I can get, and just a nice ERA, a nice whip and everything. I trust Teheran a little bit more in terms of the ERA. I could buy in. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if Shark was under 3 and had a really nice whip and everything. But if I had to pick one of them to have like a 4 ERA this year, it probably would be Shark, just because of the ballpark and the track record isn't quite what it is. The pedigree is not quite what it is with Teheran. I think I like Teheran to stay healthy a lot too, just because of the, I mean, it's kind of an easy delivery. I like the guys with the changeup. It's a really nice kind of package that he's got. So I'd go Teheran by a nose, but I doubt I'll end up with either guy.
Definitely see a more narrow range of outcomes with Teheran that could be appealing depending on what you've got on your roster at that point in the draft. Let's move on to a couple of breakout guys from last year. Jacob deGrom, who I think came out of really relative nowhere at the beginning of the year, and Carlos Carrasco, who's been on the radar for a long time and has just scuffled for years as a starter, really put it together after a stint in the bullpen, was dominant down the stretch in the second half of last year. DeGrom versus Carrasco this year only. Who do you got?
Yeah, this is another real tough one. I had Carrasco at 151, and I had DeGrom at 156. So I'll go Carrasco. Both of these guys definitely came out of nowhere and won a lot of leagues for people last year. I think I really like kind of what the Indians do with their pitchers, and maybe that kind of leads me to be a little biased towards Carrasco. I don't know. It's so close. I think that the Indians might win more games, but then again, DeGrom is probably going to be facing some worse lineups. You could definitely convince me in one way or the other, but if I had to pick one to kind of emerge as a legit high end, like number two, I think it would be Carrasco.
I had DeGrom slightly ahead. I think it's only because with Carrasco, even though I do like him for this year, we have such a long track record of struggles where I'm not convinced that like 12 starts, 12 really good starts and a good stint in the bullpen for me isn't quite enough to bump him up. And look, the counter argument there is, well, DeGrom doesn't have that long of a track record.
Yeah, both of these guys came out of nowhere for a reason.
But with DeGrom, at least we haven't seen him get just completely lit up. I mean, like he's a converted position player from college, lost a year of development time to Tommy John surgery, has shown pretty good control everywhere he's been throughout his time in the Mets system. I think that bodes pretty well, too. But I think that's where I'm willing to give him more of a pass for his age when you think about his path to becoming a starter. It took him, I think, a year or even two at Stetson University to switch from being a position player to a pitcher. So the fact that he kind of broke out in the back half of his 20s doesn't bother me as much. But I also like that he finished the season on a high note. I mean, 65-14 strikeout-to-walk ratio in his last nine starts, 59 and two-thirds innings. That, to me, bodes really well. It wasn't as though the league started to get a book on him, and by the end of the season, they were knocking him around.
Yeah, I kind of look at Carrasco as kind of a Phil Hughes, maybe, with a bit more stuff, where all he was basically doing last year was just pounding the zone, and guys just couldn't really put it into play. The thing you like about both these guys is that all the numbers kind of back up what they did last year, so it's really hard to make a compelling case that they're going to regress significantly. Both of them have a FIP under three and, XFIP right around three. So I like both guys. I don't know if I'll end up with either of them, but they're right neck and neck for me.
Let's take a look here at the next toss-up, another starting pitcher one. Zach Wheeler versus Marcus Stroman. Let's just say this is the middle rounds of the draft, and you're giddy. I mean, you're in JoJo the Idiot Circus Boy mode because both Wheeler and Stroman are on the board. Maybe you like both, but which one do you actually choose if you only get one?
Yeah, I mean, I like Stroman so much that I would have taken him over Carrasco and DeGrom. So, I mean, this one's, it's kind of easy for me just because of how much I like Stroman. I like Wheeler a lot. I might even take Wheeler over Carrasco and DeGrom too. But I think that Stroman to me is just the real deal. Everything you kind of look at, really everything you kind of look at other than his height just screams legit number two starter. And the kind of progress he made as the year went on with his pitches, I just think that there's so much. Like, you look at what each of his individual pitches did, and they were all kind of off the charts good. I think that if he kind of gets better at kind of sequencing, I mean, having Russell Martin there is going to be awesome for him in both framing and just calling a game. So I really like everything that Stroman's going to do this year. He might not get to 200 innings, but I'll take the 190 of, right around a 3 ERA, which I think I'll do this year.
Big difference in terms of the control that we've seen so far. That definitely favors Stroman, but I still think Wheeler has the higher ceiling. So maybe
I would agree with that. I would agree that Wheeler has the higher ceiling.
But Stroman, I think, has been a more finished product really since he came out of Duke. I mean, he was one of those guys when he was drafted, it was pretty clear he could be in the bullpen within a couple of months, and if they wanted to use him as a starter, he wasn't far away even in that role. Just some questions about long-term, whether he can hold up given the frame that you mentioned. But Wheeler, I mean, closer to a strikeout per inning really throughout his career, over last year just over a strikeout per inning. I think the challenging thing with pitchers who issue a lot of walks, and Wheeler certainly fits that description. We're talking 2013, 2014 walk rate, right in line with what Yu Darvish did 2012, 2013. It doesn't mean Wheeler's Darvish. It just means that more often than not, guys don't take that step forward, but sometimes they can. And Wheeler's young. I mean, he's just 24 years old. To me, it's risky to look at him and say he's just done. He's a finished product, and he's overhyped and overdrafted. Maybe he's overdrafted. Maybe he doesn't take that step forward this year. But I kind of look at the Mets, and I think, look what they did with DeGrom. I mean, look what they've done with other young pitching that developed over the last couple of years. I mean, Matt Harvey a few years ago didn't have control like he had in his breakout in 2013. That was something he sort of figured out on the fly as a big leaguer when he was first promoted back in 2012.
Yeah, I kind of look at those two guys like this. Like Stroman, if he just kind of carries over what he was doing last year, he's a number two. If Wheeler does what he does last year, he's a number three, but Wheeler needs to just make one big change and then he's a number one. So, I mean, there's more variance with Wheeler to me, but I'm in love with the safety I see in Stroman right now.
Yeah, and that seems fair enough. Here's another one where I think you'd have a lot of excitement if you're looking at these two arms. Michael Wacha versus Drew Smyly. Which direction are you going there?
I like both these guys, and I'd like to think that they're both going to end up on a lot of my teams. I actually have both of these guys. I had a Carrasco and DeGrom too. So, I mean, I would actually go Wacha here, but I'm hoping I get both these guys. Wacha to me is the guy that has the weirdest ADP right now among starting pitchers. I just don't get it at all. I think it's like 80 spots too low. You kind of look at what he did last year before he got hurt, and he kind of proved the people right that reached on him. I mean, everyone was kind of saying there's no room to profit here, and I don't like that phrase just because it kind of eliminates outcomes that actually, I mean, you could profit. I mean, you could profit on basically anybody if something goes right. But, yeah, I mean, I think Wacha was drafted pretty aggressively last year, and now all of a sudden his ADP is down closer to 200 than it is to 150, I believe, and I just don't really get that. He added some pitches. I mean, the concern was that he was a two-pitch guy going into last year. That's not the case anymore. I like the team setting. I like having Yadier Molina back there. I like the amount of wins they're going to get, the run support he's going to get. I like everything about Wacha this year. I want to own him as many places as I can.
Yeah, I like both these guys. I mean, Wacha, fully healthy, no structural damage in his shoulder, seems to be having a normal spring. I could see him making a big move up this top 350 as we move through March. And I've got Smyly. I had Smyly ranked ahead of him when spring training started, but I think they're two guys that you pretty much put side by side, and you're happy to get either one of them. The guy that I keep looking at on my rankings, and I've brought him up. I think I put him in a blog post a while back, just in the five players I don't want to own this year blog post. Sonny Gray. I like Sonny Gray. I think he's a good pitcher. I don't think he's a star, and I don't really know if I see that next level from him either. And if I don't see it, doesn't mean it's not there. But at the same time, what can he do differently than Wacha? What can he do differently than
those
guys?
He gets treated a little differently too, which I don't like. You look at Stroman, Wheeler, Wacha, Smyly, you know, DeGrom. I think Sonny Gray belongs in that grouping. Like, reasonable people could have those six guys ranked differently. But it shouldn't be unanimous that Sonny Gray is better than those guys. I could easily see any of those guys outperforming Gray, and yet Gray's getting kind of treated like that really high-end number two. And yeah, I just don't really get it. Maybe it was just that really good run he had in the postseason a couple of years ago that got people kind of on board, and then he didn't let people down. People that invested in him last year, I mean, he kind of delivered. But not in a crazy good way. I could definitely see Wacha and Smyly outperforming him.
He took on a big workload too, so I think that actually works in his favor, is that he showed he could hold up, whereas with Wacha, that wasn't the case last year. Let's talk about Francisco Liriano and Danny Salazar, two guys that have a ton of upside. Command really seems to waver from start to start. Salazar and Liriano both finishing last season on a high note. Salazar has a little bit of competition to keep his spot in the Indians rotation, whereas Liriano, after signing the extension, obviously considered like a number two, number three, essentially for the Pirates. But which one do you like better for this season?
A couple other guys that I had right by each other. I had Liriano at 170, Salazar at 178. So I'll go Liriano. I mean, the track record is pretty awesome. You know, the strikeouts are great. I mean, I think Salazar has more upside just because I think he's got the potential. Like, when Salazar's at his best, I think, you know, you can make a case that he's a legit number two, but he hasn't been there all the time. And like you said, they have options. If he's struggling, they don't have to stick with him. Liriano, though, I think he's firmly entrenched in that rotation. It's a great ballpark. It's a great defensive philosophy behind him. He's going to miss Russell Martin not being there, but I don't know. I think the fact that he has such a high walk rate and yet has always been productive with that walk rate is somewhat comforting in a weird way, that he's learned to kind of deal with it, and it doesn't really concern me that much. So, yeah, I'll go with Liriano.
Park certainly helps, too. I mean, Pittsburgh's a difficult place to hit home runs, so I think that allows you to put extra guys on base. And with Liriano, the skills otherwise are still very good. And that's the thing that continues to stand out to me. I think his struggles in the first half last year were the result of not being healthy. So I've also got Liriano ahead of Salazar for this year.
I don't think either guy gets to, I mean, I would cap them both at like 180 innings, though, if you were going to project that way. I mean, that's kind of where they kind of fall short of some of the guys in the tier above them, is that they're just not going to get you to 200.
Yeah, even like Waka, Smiley, Stroman, Wheeler, DeGrom, Carrasco, I would expect all of those guys to pitch more innings than probably both Liriano and Salazar. I think that's why Liriano and Salazar fall at least 25 picks later than most of those other pitchers that I mentioned. Let's take a look at some bullpen toss-ups. Cody Allen versus Trevor Rosenthal, if you're looking for a closer, but maybe you missed out on the first seven or eight off the board.
I'll go Cody Allen, and for me, it's not even that close, and part of that is because I owned Trevor Rosenthal everywhere last year, and I was well aware of his struggles on a night-to-night basis. I think I got to watch all of his blown saves live for some reason. I think they were all just kind of happening whenever I would flip the game on to see if he would get the save for me, and then he'd go ahead and blow it. So a little bit biased here, but I also had Allen a lot of places last year, and he was awesome. I mean, I think it kind of says a lot about that first-tier closers that he's not in it, even with as great as he was last year. I mean, just striking tons of guys out, not allowing any runs. But he's the leader in that second tier for me. If I miss out on those first guys, I'm definitely willing to grab Allen.
I would definitely like to see a little more improvement in the walk rate. A couple of years in a row now, he's been sitting in that 3.3, 3.4 range per nine, but he strikes out enough guys to overcome it.
He blows Trevor Rosenthal out of the water in the walk rate.
Exactly. I mean, like that's the thing. If you're comparing him that way, that's the big shortcoming for Rosenthal. And I see more ways where Rosenthal can lose that job, whereas I see a little more security with Cody Allen right now.
I'm going to end up with Jordan Wald in a lot of places just because I do think Rosenthal is walking on thin ice. I think it's kind of similar. It's not going to get the same kind of hype as the Detroit situation with Joe Nathan, but I think you look at the way Matheny probably feels about Rosenthal right now, I bet it's very similar to how Brett Ausmus feels about Nathan, where he's not going to waste much time early. If Rosenthal is blowing games for them and just loading the bases and giving Cardinals fans heart attacks and stuff in April, I think Matheny's going to be quick with the trigger.
Yeah, I think John Mozeliak in that front office, they sought out Jordan Walden as part of that trade when they got Jason Hayward for a reason. I think that's going to go a long way towards possibly stabilizing the ninth inning for the Cardinals if Rosenthal continues to struggle this season. Let's move a little further down the closer ranks. Zach Britton or Jonathan Papelbon? Knowing that Papelbon, there's a good chance he gets traded. I just wonder if a team would actually trade for him and not have him close.
Yeah, this one is probably the one I'm least confident about in. I would go with Zach Britton, but it's tough for me to go with a guy who's going to be closing games and not giving me that many strikeouts. I buy into the ground ball rate so much so that I'm kind of willing to look past the lack of strikeouts and kind of think that he can outperform. Like his FIP and his XFIP and everything suggests that he was pitching way above his head last year. That's just because he wasn't striking everybody out. But, I mean, if you believe in the ground ball rate and you believe in that defense behind him, I mean, Machado and J.J. Hardy, I mean, that's a really nice left side of the infield defensively. I think that he can repeat what he did to some extent with the run prevention, maybe something in the mid twos. And I think that's going to be a good situation for him to get saves.
Yeah, I'm going to go Papelbon just slightly here. I think they're both going to be lower than what you want in terms of strikeout rate, but I think you get a little more from Papelbon. I guess I am in the camp that thinks if he gets traded, any team that's willing to take on that salary, they want him to close. So I don't worry about him being traded.
I think you almost want him to get traded because I don't think Philly's going to win any games this year. So, I mean, it'd be nice. Like, I'd much prefer Papelbon on the Brewers than I would the Phillies right now.
Yeah, and I would
and that's
much
not
prefer,
gonna happen now.
I'd much prefer Papelbon to K-Rod, too, but that also...
Where is there anywhere you can see Rosenthal going? Or, I mean, Papelbon going now that the Brewers have K-Rod? Is it just going to take an injury?
It's probably going to take an injury. Who else was even in the running for him originally? I mean, Kenley Jansen is not down long enough for the Dodgers to do it.
I mean, the Diamondbacks would be a really funny landing spot just because they shouldn't give up anything for a closer. But I don't know if I'd quite put it past them. But yeah, it's hard to think of ideal landing spots now that the Brewers have K-Rod.
And the thing about the Diamondbacks is they actually match up pretty well with Philadelphia. They've got some excess. They have some veteran types they could send back who would actually play for the Phillies and just take up space and maybe become useful pieces to flip again at the deadline. They could actually swing something.
They have a sneaky deep farm system too. So I mean, yeah, that that's something that where it could happen. It just doesn't make any sense in terms of where Arizona is on the win curve. But maybe they think that they're closer to contending than the rest of the world.
Maybe there'd be some kind of Hoyer, Theo, Papelbon reunion if our next guy falters. Hector Rondon versus Neftali Feliz. And the more I look at Rondon, the more I like him because he pitched really well on the stretch last year. I went Feliz here because I think Feliz, further removed from Tommy John surgery, might see that uptick where you see the velocity come back a little bit more. Maybe everything's going to be a little more crisp. Things are going to be normal throughout this offseason, so we're going to see a more vintage version of him. It's speculative, but that's just the way I've been leaning so far on this one.
I'm also going to go with Phillies. It is close, though. I mean, these guys are definitely kind of in the same tier if you're talking closers. I think Feliz's strikeout rate from last year is very misleading. You just kind of look at what he's done in prior years, and you know, like you said, you know, a year further removed, I think that maybe the stuff comes back to the point where he can get back up to around a K per inning. And if that's the case, then I think he could really deliver. I don't see the Rangers being in any rush at all to take that job from him, even if he struggles a little bit early, just because he's such a kind of a prized piece of that organization, or at least he once was, that I think they'd really love for him to kind of round into being their closer for the next 3 or 4 years.
I think that's definitely a possibility. They do have some depth options that are intriguing, but both of these guys I feel like are kind of equal in terms of potential job security. I think Feliz gets even a slight edge, though, based on what we have right now on each of those teams' respective depth charts. One more closer toss-up to get to. Santiago Casilla versus K-Rod, and I hope I'm not making this decision anywhere where I have to choose one of these guys to be my third closer, but it very well may happen. Which direction do you want to go between those two?
I will take Santiago Casilla, and it's kind of a process of elimination call. I mean, I'm with you. I've Casilla ranked far enough down where I doubt I'll end up with him anywhere. I know I won't end up with K-Rod anywhere, just because I just keep having these premonitions where I wake up sweating and K-Rod's just blown his third save in seven games, and it's sad, and Jonathan Broxton gets the ball the next game and then blows it. I mean, I can just see all kinds of gas cans being lit in the infield, and that Brewers bullpen this year, it's just not going to be fun, and I don't want any part of it from a fantasy perspective.
I didn't think the bullpen was good, but at the same time, I didn't think it was bad enough to need K-Rod, if that makes any sense.
I think that we found a way to kind of find two guys that their numbers suggest that they could be good, but we found the perfect two guys that are just going to implode at the same time in Broxton and K-Rod, and it's not going to be that fun to watch.
It definitely could happen. I don't even like Santiago Casilla, but I would take him over
either.
K-Rod.
I wouldn't be surprised if Santiago Casilla lost his job either, but it would be more surprising to me than if K-Rod lost his.
The thing about it, though, the main reason I like Casilla better is just the margin for error in the park.
Right, the park is huge.
Yeah, Miller Park's not a good fit for K-Rod. No. I mean, he misses his spots now. The stuff isn't very good. He gets hit hard. No. I mean, when he has pinpoint control, he's okay. He's fine.
He's the type of closer that gives up those game-winning bombs that just never come down. You know, like the 450-foot walk-off bombs, which are somewhat like worse than just the ones that just get over the wall because it's just so embarrassing.
Yeah, in the NL Central, those land in streets and rivers.
Streets and rivers, yep.
Usually, so it's not good. Maybe that's what I'll start calling K-Rod. Start calling them streets and rivers, which is just going to be the best nickname ever for any closer. All right, so we're going to close things out with the Get to Know Your Host segment. Let's just say all of your hats are being destroyed right now in a fire, but the good news is you have time to grab one. Which hat are you saving?
Well, this is kind of a sad hypothetical. I'm gonna go with practicality here, which is kind of the boring way to go. But I like to ski and I like to go to football games when the weather's cold. So I would grab my winter hat, which is it's like an old 2008 Olympics Winter Olympics hat or 2010 Winter Olympics, whenever that was. Winter hat, just because I want to stay warm. Like, I don't need to wear a baseball hat. I can just go with, I can buzz my head, which I do in the summer anyways, and I don't wear hats in the summer. So, I'd just go with a winter hat just for practicality purposes.
Yeah, I thought about the winter hat route, but I don't really like any. I have a Packer one that I like, but I don't like any of my other winter hats very much right now. I'd probably save. I've been wearing this Angels hat a lot. My hats are cyclical. I get into one hat for a while, kind of trash it, and then it's just gone. I don't. There's a certain point. Some people like to keep the same hat forever, and it gets really grimy. I get to a point where if I take it off, yeah, and it's like the sweat is still kind of warm from the last time I wore it, when I put the hat back on, that's when I throw it away. Like, when it can't dry out anymore, I'm done with it.
You don't want to be able to kind of like rub your fingernail on the bill of the hat and like dig up like layers of stuff from the top of your hat. And,
right.
And that's when you know it's done. So I actually sometimes I'll give up on hats after like two or three times wearing them if I'm just not feeling them. Like I've got a couple of Brewers hats that I bought spur of the moment and just decided I didn't like them anymore. So just they're just sitting there collecting dust.
Now you got to get those to the park on opening day. I'm sure there's some drunk tailgaters that'd be happy to buy some hats from you. At least you could turn some hats into trade them. You could trade them for a few beers or something in the parking lot.
I could, I suppose, but then I'd have to talk to drunk people in that I don't know in the Miller Park parking lot,
which generally not fun. What I've found is something I've noticed just by going to more parks the last couple of years. I tend to like the fans in pretty much every park I go to more than, yes, I like my fellow fans at, yes, Miller Park, and I feel bad about it.
Except for I totally agree with you. There was one time when I went to a game in Atlanta, and it was Braves Cardinals, and I was visiting my sister who lived there at the time, and the Cardinals fans that traveled for that game were worse than Brewers fans in Miller Park. But that's the only time that I can think of where a group of fans was worse than Miller Park fans.
Here's my issue with Miller Park fans. Here's my problem. And again, I'm a Brewers fan. Yes. I like going to Miller Park. I have a good time when I go. But oftentimes, the people around me irritate me for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, people walk into the game in the third inning sometimes, which doesn't make any sense.
That probably happens more parks than you would think, though.
Yes, but like in LA, it happens because of traffic.
Right.
In Milwaukee, it happens because people have to have their fourth or fifth beer in the parking lot.
Or seventh or eighth. That's my biggest problem is people are just too drunk.
Yeah, exactly. That's the issue for me. I like beer. I like beer and baseball. I like going to games and having beer. But there are limits. I mean, like, I am going to the game to watch the game.
I will say this. Like, there's people that can handle drinking a decent amount of beer before a baseball game, and there's people that can't. And I feel like more often than not, it's people that can't that go to Miller Park where they're just yelling all game. I mean, like, I can go and have, I can get close to finishing off a six-pack, and I can go to the game and just kind of watch the game and just talk with my friends. I don't have to be yelling stuff. I don't have to take my shirt off. I don't have to kind of be wandering around at the bottom of the aisle and trying to get people to do the wave. I mean, there's ways to behave and there's ways not to behave, and it seems to be the latter in a lot of cases.
And you can check off all of those fans from any section in the park almost any game of the year. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that it's like it's a generally, for a crowd that drinks as much as they do, it's still generally a happy crowd, but in terms of the way people talk about baseball,
it's not a very knowledgeable crowd at,
yes,
all.
It is an opinionated drunk crowd that doesn't know a lot, and that just grates on me.
I don't know if you're with me on this at all, but I really don't care for fans that wear, like, that go to a Brewers game and wear like a bunch of Packers gear, and I feel like that happens a lot. I just kind of prefer you to not wear any fandom gear at all if you don't have any Brewers stuff.
Just wear a blue shirt. Yeah. Just wear a shirt that's, yeah, the color of the team you like. Doesn't have to be a Brewers shirt.
Yeah. Wear a white shirt or a black shirt or a blue shirt.
Something neutral. Like just like common sense.
The Packers jersey and a cheese head at a Brewers game, I mean, that's just the worst.
Yeah, but that person thinks that they're awesome because, yeah, they're supporting two, yeah, teams at once, yeah, in their mind.
Just like, in case you didn't know, I also like the Packers.
Yeah, shocker, right? Shocker that you're at a Brewer game and you're also a Packer fan. We've never seen anyone like that. All right, so if you have any questions you'd like us to tackle in a future episode, strategies for drafts, pickups, whatever it might be, specific players, maybe you have a get-to-know-your-host question for us, hit us up on Twitter at Derek Van Riper and at RealJRAnderson. You can also email us at fantasybaseballpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening to the RotoWire Fantasy Baseball Podcast. And again, if you listen to us on iTunes or Stitcher, you can please rate and review the podcast. We're really appreciative of any and all feedback that we get. We'll be back with you on Tuesday. Also have a new prospect pod coming out on Tuesday. Be sure to check those out. Have a great day.